Hello and welcome back to Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. I'm your host, Josh Campbell. Render Unto Caesar seeks to explore the connection between religion and the public sphere. The title comes from one of the more well-known events in Jesus' life when he gets asked if a devout Jew should pay taxes to Rome. Jesus says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's." This is part two of a two-part series of interviews with Elaine Enns and Ched Myers. Today we continue to look at what it means to be a disciple of Christ in the first world through the lens of their book, Healing Haunted Histories. In particular, we focus on what discipleship looks like for a Christian settler like myself. Thanks for listening.
So I want to get into a couple questions from the Healing Haunted Histories, a settler discipleship of decolonization. When I was listening, I listened to the talk you folks gave to the Mennonite Saskatchewan group. And one of the things you mentioned was that facing haunting can lead to action. What does it mean to face haunting?
We appreciate the work of sociologist Avery Gordon. And she focuses on how soil, soul, and society are haunted by past and continuing violence. And so in the US and Canada, systems and ideologies of settler colonialism inflicted genocide on Indigenous people. And so the ghosts of that unresolved oppression haunt us white settlers who participate in and benefit from that legacy. And so in the book, we talk about how our silence is not going to heal us. But if we face our complicity, learn the stories, like I was talking about, of our settler ancestors and the historical violence Indigenous people survived, and are in cooperation or relationship with Indigenous communities, figuring out how to practice restorative solidarity and reparative justice. That is how we are describing we can walk towards healing. This Avery Gordon asserts that, and this is a quote, "Haunting is a constituent element of modern social life, a generalizable social phenomenon of great import. And to study social life, one must confront the ghostly aspects of it." So she describes the more modern forms of dispossession, exploitation, and repression, and their concrete impact on the people most affected by them.
She also says that only by facing these hauntings can we actually resolve them. Drugs can't do it. Denial can't do it. It actually only represses it further so that it surges up. We talked a little while ago about how the Who Will Roll Away the Stone book was written on the heels of the Los Angeles uprising. That uprising was the result of the haunting of racism and police, endemic police violence against African Americans that just sits in the unconscious, the collective unconscious of America because of 400 years of chattel slavery and white supremacy. And until and unless justice is done, we will remain haunted. Here we are, tomorrow, the anniversary of George Floyd. Why was there such a huge outcry after the police murder of George Floyd? It certainly wasn't the only police murder of a black man, even that week, much less that year. But it was one because it was captured on video, because of the particular circumstances around it. What happened is the haunted unconscious both white and black people roared to the surface. There were massive demonstrations. There was a massive white backlash. And here we are, right back in this issue, having to face this core strand of racism in our culture. So that's what hauntings do. But when we face the hauntings and try to heal these systems, whether it's through defunding the police, different training, anti-racism training, then we can begin to heal.
Well, yeah, and I just want to make sure to add that you know, hauntings again provoke these powerful positive uprisings and revolutionary movements for social transformation. Idle No More is absolutely, that is just such an awesome movement coming out of Saskatchewan. Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, Standing Rock, all of those are gifts to us to join with these movements, because our as settlers, our learning and the restitution work we need to do and our healing is bound up with and alongside these social movements.
So I was on a webinar yesterday, which was just here in the county that we live in, Ventura County, north of Los Angeles, was a 90 people of faith got on this call to say, where are we in our anti-racism work? And one after another, Catholic, Methodist, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Quaker, Jewish, people got on and said, we're having substantial conversations in our congregations, in our denominations, as a result of George Floyd's murder and the uprising that followed it. So this is how change happens, by facing our hauntings. Mm-hmm. And yet we have this culture of denial, this culture of disappearing that which is inconvenient. And unfortunately, Christian theologies and spiritualities, which want to disavow this history in order to only focus on a heavenly future, are really part of the problem of a denial culture. And our Christianity really has to be open-eyed and awake, looking at ourselves, looking at our history, rather than gazing beyond. There are beautiful tropes in our scriptures that talk about that. Jesus heals the blind who get up and follow in discipleship. When Jesus ascends, we just had Ascension Sunday a little while ago. When Jesus ascends to heaven, the angels tell the people staring up into heaven, why are you looking up into heaven? Your job is here to bring the kingdom of God, the great economy. So we have a powerful tradition in our Christian faith, but it's also a deeply compromised and colonized tradition. So in this new book, we try to talk about, we will not get to, Christians will not be able to jump into the decolonization movement until we actually understand how our own tradition has been colonized. So we're decolonizing Christianity in order to be Christian decolonial allies. And that's really what this book is about.
That's so good. I was just going to say, it's, you know, in my journey in this way, you guys, I can remember one of the questions I had here was practicing solidarity with Indigenous communities, but I feel like I'm going to answer it here myself. So I was thinking, you know, Cam Fraser, who you folks know, we had the Colton Bushy murder a couple years ago. It was a young Indigenous man in the prairies, and he held a rally. He didn't hold the rally. There was some Indigenous protesters that planned some action, and he just created the church space to say, you can come back here, have soup. We're going to be with you. And I remember going on this march, and we We stood in the middle of an intersection of our city and people were honking horns and stuff. And I was like, is this what it means to be a disciple today? You know? I remember we had two young children. One was in a stroller and my wife was panicking. Like, should I get them off the road or like, you know, feeling, I don't know. When I think about what you guys are saying, that comes to mind. And I'm so glad that Cam took the leadership, which really he wasn't leading it. He just was, we're just here to support, you know? But is that kind of what this solidarity looks like for us today?
Well, as we speak on this day, it's the day after Pentecost. And what is Pentecost except a huge street demonstration of people whose hearts and minds have been gripped by the power and hope of the resurrected Jesus, right? Literally, the story of Pentecost in the book of Acts is the movement from the upper room of disciples cowering after their leader has been executed, hiding out from the authorities, encountering the risen Christ, and then going out onto the streets to proclaim this kingdom of God, this great economy, and proclaiming it in everyone's native tongue, not in the language of empire, but in all the small little dialects. So the only thing cooler than you all being out on the streets where you were there in Regina would have been if you could have been proclaiming the gospel in Cree. That would have really been cool. But that's all right. That's our tradition. And we've forgotten that. Our churches still are too much cowering in an upper room. And I think you experience when you're out on the street standing with disenfranchised communities, there's a congruence with our gospel.
I'm grateful you brought up the, what is that restorative solidarity, and how we talk about restorative solidarity is, you know, of course there's different steps to it. And first is doing our own work. And that is about learning the history of our ancestral immigrants, the land they settled on, and the stories of violence and injustice that happened there and continue to happen there. And then our practices of resettling and settling again and again on Indigenous lands, and what the history is and what the contemporary reality is for Indigenous folks. So that's the part of doing our own work and our complicity in those systems of colonization. But then we do talk about acts of solidarity and reparation and repatriation in relationships with these Indigenous communities injured both in the past and in the present. And so these different acts that we are a part of, an important piece of restorative solidarity is to go out on the street, but then to come back together to evaluate what has happened in, of course, conversation with Indigenous folks. What worked, what didn't work, what are the next steps we want to do together? Or like you described it, how do we support the work that Indigenous people are trying to do around issues of protest and struggles for justice? So that is kind of the loop of restorative practices of restorative solidarity. But the ultimate goal of a discipleship of decolonization is to wrestle with reparations and how we will come to all be doing that work. And when we say that, we're not only talking about farmland, we are talking also about the ownership and the wealth we have inherited for those of us that live in the city.
And before we leave this, in the middle of this book, we offer a reflection on what does it mean to be covenantal people. We Christians, as part of people of the book, are supposed to be part of a tradition that goes back to the Hebrew Bible in which people make covenants. They make agreements, and they make them with each other, and they make them with specific land, and they make them with the Creator, right? That's the very roots of our tradition in the Hebrew Bible. 20 years ago, Roger Epp, Albertan, Mennonite, wrote a book about becoming treaty people.
We are all treaty people.
It's actually become a trope now that has spread wide across Canada. What does it mean for us to become treaty people in the current history of Saskatchewan or in California, where there actually were no treaties? The settlers didn't even settler state didn't even bother to make treaties with Indigenous people where we are. And yet both of our places, Saskatchewan and California, have many federally unrecognized bands who are still looking for recognition and justice. What does it mean for us to become treaty people? Well, for heaven's sakes, Christians are supposed to be treaty people. We're supposed to make covenants. They're supposed to be public. And yet it was once again Cree elders who had a much more robust sense when they signed treaties 150 years ago that they were making promises before the Creator, which were sacred and made sacred by the smoking of the pipe. They had the sense that treaties were spiritual covenants. It was the settlers who saw them, saw treaty as just kind of a legal mechanism to get title to land so that we could exploit and own land. So we Christians need to recover a sense of covenant with ourselves, with Indigenous peoples, and with the land and with the Creator. And that's why in our work, we talk about our focus is not just on discipleship, but on radical discipleship. And by that, we mean not just a trendy term for being an activist, but the word radical, as you know, comes from the Latin radix, which means going to the roots. And for us as settlers, that means going to the roots of our settler history and figuring out what justice means. But it also means going to the roots of our biblical faith and tradition, and recovering that call of the great economy, that call to discipleship, and that call to be covenant people.
And I just want to interrupt for a sec or just interject this. Ched just made a brief reference to a book that I think Saskatchewan settlers need to get their hands on. It is the Treaty Elders of Saskatchewan. Yes. And we got a copy from Harry LaFond when he was executive director of the Office of the Treaty Commissioner, mm-hmm. Saskatchewan. And I know Hildebrandt is one of the authors, but I couldn't find it. It's in our book. But I just strongly encourage those of us that are interested in understanding sacred treaty. And we use that book, read it through the lens of our understanding of treaty with covenant that we make between land, Creator, and people. So I just encourage folks to look at that book.
Beautiful book in which elders throughout Saskatchewan were interviewed about what treaty meant and means to them. And oh, we were just, beautiful. It was a religious experience for us reading this beautiful little book that is available through the Office of the Treaty Commission.
Treaty Elders of Saskatchewan is what it's called.
Okay. Yeah. Published maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
No.
Or more.
I got it. Harry gave it to me after my DM.
Yeah. So maybe 7 or 8 years.
Yeah. 10, maybe.
I'll note that. Thank you. One of the quotes that came up when I listened to your talk about your recent book was the killing system of white supremacy is also killing us. Meaning white people. I just wanted to share with you folks, and this is another thing. One of your chapters, Elaine, talks about you discovering, I think, your Ukrainian back or Russian background, and I wanted to share with you just if it's okay. I want to share with you a clip from an elder. Willie Ermine, and he teaches at First Nations University. And he talks about this idea of the wealth of people and how understanding where your background is really it part of what makes you a wealthy person. Is it okay if I just play you this clip and you could comment on it?
Totally, okay. Yes.
It was from a course that I had to take as a teacher on reconciliation, actually. And I'm just going to play it from this part. But when you were talking about rediscovering your own ancestry, it made me think of this clip.
Media, what you hear from different sources would be, oh, those poor Indigenous people, those poor First Nations people in that community. Oh, they're poor, the Aboriginal people. You know, all these wrongs have been done to them. Oh, they need healing. Oh, we have to have pity for the Aboriginal people. You know, this is sort of the discourse that permeates society, you know, that we need healing. You know, some people will see this, well, this is, you know, recovering from student residence. We need healing. That's why we're doing this. We're not doing it for that. Because the systems in the Western system that have been operative, you know, that have been in place for a long time, I ask students, I am a Cree person, you know. My mother, my father, I can name them, my grandfather, my grandmother, my great-grandfather, and so forth, and which land I come from, and what my Cree name is, what my attachment to the universe is, what land I come from. And I can tell you about my identity, and I can speak Cree. I can speak my Cree language. Then I ask the students, I want you to do the same thing. I want you to tell me where you are from, where your parents came from, where your grandparents came from. And then at the end, I want you to speak your language. And usually, nobody can do that. And I tell them, well, who's poor in this equation? You know, who needs help? I can do all these identity things and everything that you know about me, but you can't do the same. So the systems that we're talking about are impacting not only Indigenous people, but more so all the non-Indigenous people in this country.
So I'm going to stop it there.
Yeah.
But man, when I saw that as part of this course, that just that hit me really hard. And that was Professor Willie Ermine speaking. He's a professor at First Nations University, and he's talking about his non-Indigenous students. He goes on that clip to say, you people get PhDs and study my people. Why don't you go study your people?
Absolutely. I mean, and that, Josh, that is exactly what we are arguing in this book. We need to understand where we have come from and the huge losses that we as white people have endured. Because we, you know, when we became white, when did that happen? And how did that happen? And why, especially in the church, wasn't there a pushback to say, we need to hold on to our ethnic identity? So part of this, I just loved what he was saying, because that is so true. We ask folks, you know, and in our settler working with in the settler workshops, I'm just leading two workshops now, to, you know, tell us something about your immigrant ancestors and some of the cultural practices. And exactly, can you name the name of your great-great-grandmother? Do you know what language she spoke? When was that language lost? And you know, there's sometimes howls of protest. How am I supposed to know that, and why is that important? And I think this elder makes it very clear. We are bereft. We are orphaned. Those of us who have assimilated into white, into whiteness, which of course is a fiction, and we've lost a great deal. So part of our work is is talking about de-assimilation and all of the losses in that.
So one of the foci of this book is the particular struggle of the Young Chipewyan Band, which is federally unrecognized in Canada, in Saskatchewan, to not only regain status, but also regain land that was taken from them without consultation or compensation in the 1890s, and given to Mennonite and other settlers up in the Obwashamo-Chilkatenau area near Rostron, where you've visited. And so we talk about the efforts by Mennonite Central Committee and local farmers to meet with young Chipewyans.
And there's also Lutheran. Lutheran settlers, and the Lutheran church there is a part of those reconciliation efforts as well.
So this is these are the closing paragraphs of the book.
Okay. These are hopeful signs unfolding in my place of Saskatchewan and among my people, exploring solidarity, reparation, and repatriation. But we have a long way to go to heal the haunting of Reserve 107, that is the Young Chipewyan Territory, and all the other wounds of colonization within and among us. Standing on Obwashamo-Chilkatenau, this was May 2015, surrounded by family and friends, I thought about what was here before. You will know the name Henry Kelsey is the first settler explorer and the Hudson's Bay Company about how the Indigenous stewards of this place could have taught us how to live more sustainably had we listened, and about the solemn covenants about which the Cree elders spoke. I thought about the settler name of this place, and that is Stony Knoll. Joshua of old told the people at Shechem, "This stone heard all your words and shall be a witness against you if you break faith." We, the children of the colonial settler project, have indeed broken faith toward lands, peoples, and creator. There is so much history to turn around. Chet and I talked afterwards about another scripture that employs a similar metaphor. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Creator's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. This is from Mark 12, 10 to 11. The psalmist's counterintuitive wisdom was so important to our ancestors in the faith that it is invoked half a dozen times in the Second Testament. Part of what we talk about in the book is song lines that inspire our faith and our solidarity. So this is an ancient song line which invites us to embrace Indigenous peoples, the very ones whom the builders of the colonial project categorically rejected, as the keystone of a decolonized future.
Hello, and thanks for listening to Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. If you're just joining us now, I'm talking with Elaine Enns and Ched Myers about their latest book called Healing Haunted Histories, A Settler Discipleship of Decolonization. In their book, Elaine and Ched highlight three lines of connection. The first, landlines, is about revisiting where and how our ancestors settled and how we came to reside on the land that we inhabit today. Bloodlines is about settlers reversing the ignorance of our familial and communal stories. Finally, songlines, which Elaine just talked about before the break, refers to traditions that empower us to make things right by embracing restorative solidarity and working to redistribute wealth, land, and power. In the past segment, we touched on some of these lines. I really encourage folks to go deeper by purchasing their book. I'll have details on how to get it at the end of the show. In the next part of the show, We talk about the courage required to face the hauntings of our settler past. We also compare the decolonization conversation in Canada to what is happening in the United States. Thanks for listening.
One of the last things here from your talk about your book I wanted to touch on was, I think it was you, Elaine, that talked about widespread moves to innocence
and
agnosia and transcendent denial. I was wondering if you could just expand on that phrase. What do you mean by widespread moves to innocence?
We feel this is so common. There are lots of common tropes that settlers will just spill out. Oh, that was so long ago. Why are we talking about that? I did not, like in the US, I did not own slaves, or with Indigenous land, like I did not take this land from Indigenous people. Why don't we just let sleeping dogs lie? This is not my fault. You know, an Indigenous friend of ours down here talks about how settlers will tell her, "We won. Just get over it." Those are all settler moves to innocence, and they're couched in this. Can be categorized as agnosia or willful ignorance. We don't know what happened in the past. We don't care about what happened in the past, and we don't care that we don't know. So it's sociologists Eve Tuck and Wayne Yang that have called these kind of moves, they call them moves to innocence. And it says that there is nothing in the past that I am accountable to. So sometimes, you know, this is a dangerous determinism, an appeal to progress. This conquest was inevitable. Somebody was going to conquest this land. Our ancestors just happened to do it. Or personal dissociation. This is viewing an ahistoric individualism or kind of a detachment from history. You know, that says I'm not accountable to history, nor did I benefit from history. It just imagines that. Or, you know, some progressives sometimes think we can exonerate ourselves by conscientization, right? Doing this kind of trenchant analysis to decolonize our minds. And of course, this cannot stand in for the more uncomfortable work of digging down into our personal histories of how we have benefited from white privilege or colonialism. And then, you know, just lastly, I do feel it's important to talk about some folks blame Christianity for all that has gone wrong, right? And have, or certainly for the colonial project. And in becoming post-Christian, dump their faith traditions, thinking that in that dumping, they will release themselves from responsibility. But of course, that doesn't. And, you know, Indigenous folks that we have worked with want us to stay in our tradition and do the hard wrestling of holding that tradition accountable. So these settler moves to innocence are ubiquitous in our conversations, and they bubble up in ourselves. And that is exactly what the work we are trying to do, to name the moves to innocence that we are all so used to reciting, and facing the hauntings that demand a more truthful response.
Do you, just one last thing, do you, what's the conversation like in United States versus Canada? I mean, you folks have an interesting window into this whole, because, you know, I mean, you hail from the two different countries. What's your gauge of this conversation about decolonization in the US versus what's in California versus Saskatchewan?
I think we would still hands down say that the Canadian conversation is ahead of what is happening in the US. Even the, you know, it's getting more familiar, but the use of the term to refer to us as settlers is still resistant, still resisted in much, much of the U.S. Here, you know, we do have the horrible, we have the two horrible histories of the first layer of violence being indigenous genocide and dispossession, and then the second layer of chattel slavery. And the conversation around reparations for enslaved persons of descendants of enslaved persons has been a more lively conversation, but I do believe that Idle No More helped for sure kick off Standing Rock. And so this conversation around Indigenous reparations and solidarity just in the last couple of years here in the U.S. has really started to become more a part of what we're wrestling with together.
Our work with Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries is intentionally binational, and this book is binational, not only because of our respective storylines, but because we understand that there are many similarities and then also important differences between Canada and the United States. We tracked very carefully the Truth and Reconciliation process in Canada. Elaine attended two different hearings in Nova Scotia and Saskatchewan, and really tried to apprentice ourselves to what was going on there. And we attempted to convene some gatherings down here in California to talk to Americans about the TRC as it was going on in Canada 10 years ago. We couldn't get traction. People didn't know about it. They weren't really that interested. And that was very disappointing, if not surprising to us. Elaine keeps mentioning Standing Rock because in many ways Standing Rock was a turning point in 2017 in the popular consciousness. And since then, we've held three annual institutes in a row looking at settler indigenous issues. And, you know, they've been 100, 150 people coming together to do this work. So it is changing. We feel we have a lot to learn from Canadians, both indigenous and settler, who are doing this critical work around decolonization. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that in the U.S. we have a longer, deeper, broader history of other indigenous and communities of color involved in social struggles, such as the civil rights movement, and particularly people of faith. And so I think that's a lot to bring to the table, and to we find that many of our Canadian friends appreciate learning about those traditions. So we think that we're all in this together, and are interested in building a North American movement around decolonization. We do want to let your listeners know that in Canada, the Healing Haunted Histories book is being carried by a Winnipeg-based outfit. You want to talk about that?
Common Word is carrying the book, and they're actually carrying it at a discount. We're very grateful to Mennonite Church Canada that is helping to make it more affordable for a Canadian audience. So you can really go to healinghauntedhistories.org. That is our website, and has a link there for Canadians to purchase through Common Word.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, folks.
That wraps up another edition of Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. One thing that I wish I would have explored more in this show was the idea of reparations. At one point in our interview, Elaine talked about it being vital in any conversation about reconciliation. Thankfully, her and Chet address it at length in Chapter 8 of their book. Check it out. As I thought more about reparations, I decided to do a bit more digging myself. This led me to an article in Briar Patch magazine called Sharing Treaty Land by Katie Doak Sawatsky. There I learned about the Treaty Land Sharing Network, a grassroots group of settler farmers, ranchers, and other landholders willing to share their land with Indigenous land users in Saskatchewan. I had heard about this group because I have friends that are involved in it. One of those friends talks about the importance of reconciliation being more than just about saying sorry, but actual acts of reparation, like the return of land from settlers to Indigenous people. Interestingly, this led me to a Chatelaine article by Denise Balkasun. Balkasun is someone who has also been wrestling with her settler identity, especially in light of the hundreds of unmarked graves found on residential school sites this past year. She writes that in all of her learning about this, one thing sticks out, and I quote, "As I keep reading, listening, watching documentaries, and asking questions, one core need and right keeps presenting itself. It would provide fair reparations for residential schools and also be a source of healing from the many traumas Canada is still visiting on Indigenous peoples. Boiled down to two words, it's land back. Returning a meaningful amount of land to First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people so that they can rebuild their connection to it and to each other." Balkasun continues by saying that giving land back to Indigenous people around the world would also help us mitigate the climate crisis we're now in. In 2019, the UN said that even though Indigenous people comprise less than 5% of the world's population, they safeguard 80% of its remaining biodiversity. Millions of tons of carbon are stored in forests managed by Indigenous people, including the boreal forests in Canada. So for me, this isn't just a justice issue, but also one of stewardship. Settler culture has so much to learn from Indigenous knowledge, and if we don't, it will be at our own peril. If you're wanting to dig deeper into this, please check out Elaine and Chad's book, and specifically Chapter 8 about reparations. Besides the article I already mentioned, Briar Patch magazine also has a whole issue dedicated to the land back concept in their fall 2020 edition. Please check it out. Next time on Render Unto Caesar, we'll be hearing from Shawnee Lenape scholar and author Stephen Newcomb. In 2008, Newcomb wrote his landmark book, Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery. In this episode, I talk with Newcomb about this doctrine and the connections that it has to unmarked graves being found in residential school sites today. And before I let you go, I just want to end today's show with a little chat that I had with Elaine and Chet about a radical discipleship institute that they will be holding in California this coming February. If you're interested, please take a listen and get more information online at bcm-net.org. Thanks for listening.
And also, you mentioned this conference. I was looking at a website yesterday, and I was thinking that would be a great thing to take in. What is that going to be back up in February next year, or?
Absolutely, we are planning for an in-person gathering. February 2022, it will be in that third week of February. I should have those dates handy. It is a wonderful time for Canadians to come and join us. It is generally very lovely weather. We hope for rain during that time, and it usually doesn't. So it is sunny and gorgeous. It will likely be February 21st to the 25th, if not the weekend before. So we are so grateful to Canadians that make the long journey down here.
And we always have a handful.
And we always, we often have people from Saskatchewan, but really all of the provinces have been represented there. And it's a wonderful gathering and a good time of disciples keeping one another's courage up. Together and asking pressing questions of how we live more faithfully into our discipleship.
This will be our 15th year of doing these institutes. Actually, we held an institute in Saskatoon in 2016.
Yes.
But usually they're here in our watershed, and we really think you ought to come down, Josh, because we are going to, this next year is going to be our second Festival of Radical Discipleship, where people doing all kinds of expressions of faith and justice work are going to be talking about their work. So if you can wiggle out of your school responsibilities, maybe you can come join us.
Well, I was curious if that's the third week of February. That's my reading week. So
there you go.
Nice.
Yeah. Kids are welcome too.
Kids are welcome. We don't have a huge children's program, but there are always a handful of children that are directed by our children's chaplain, Christina Mata. So would be fun. Yeah.